answer was this city, where all the people were gray and all the houses and buildings were painted gray. And everywhere you looked around you, well, everything was gray. In this city, there lived a magician who kind of grew sick of the situation. He said, well, maybe I should do something about it, help people a bit. So he went to his house, went down the spiral staircase up to his basement where he was keeping all his weird stuff. The bottles with different liquids inside, and he put the pot on the fire. I mean, he took a little bit of this and a little bit of that and made the weird mixture and started stirring it with a big wooden spoon. And in the end, well, he came up with red. He really liked red, so he took a bucket and a brush and went outside his house to the fence and started painting it red. Now, imagine this little spot of red inside all this grayness. I mean, people were stopping outside his house, looking at the fence, amazed. And they could knock on his door and start asking for a little paint, if he could just give them some red paint. And of course he did, that was the point actually. So the people took the paint and they painted their houses red, and they painted the buildings red, and they painted their clothes red, so that now everywhere you would look around you, there was all this redness. But red is a very strong color. It keeps you at the edge of the seat. You cannot relax with red. So the people started getting nervous, and they were starting to cross each other, and the conflicts started appearing in the city. So the merchant, when he saw this, he said, well, this won't do. This won't do at all. I should do something about it. So he went back to his house, down the spiral staircase to his basement, put the pot on the fire, started mixing different liquids this time, a little bit of this bottle and a little bit of that bottle. And he came up with yellow. So he took a bucket and a brush, went outside his house, painted the door of his fence yellow. Now, people who had grew tired of so much red, when they looked at the yellow spot, well, they just started asking for it again. Immediately, they would knock on the magician's door and ask for paint, and they would paint their houses yellow and the buildings yellow and the clothes yellow. And then it would be a whole bright city full of yellow everywhere, only it was a little bit too bright. So you had this reflection coming to your eyes from everywhere. They started wearing hats to protect their eyes from all the light because it was really irritating. And after a while, they wouldn't have it. So the magician thought that, I did it again. Well, I should do something about it, I guess. So down to the basement, through the spiral staircase, a little bit of this bottle and a little bit of that in the pot, and then he came up with blue. So he took the bucket and he took the brush and painted his fence blue this time. And everybody liked it. It was like relaxing after all those yellow colors everywhere. Their eyes could relax for a little bit. So they started painting their houses blue, and the buildings blue, and the clothes blue. And then there was this blue calm everywhere. So they just got to you after a little while. Well, people would start feeling less active and maybe would sleep in a little more in the morning and not really want to go to work and feeling a little bit blue, I guess. So when the magician saw that, well, he said, God, no, not again. But one day, a couple was walking through all the blue buildings and the blue houses towards the edge of the city, where they saw that a woman who was living in a house had painted the roof of the house red and the rest of the house yellow, and all the windows and the fence were blue. And they were like, wow, how did she do that? And they decided to use all the paint that was left and do the same to their house. And then when other people saw it, well, they just imitated it. And after a little while, you could see colors all over the city. There are some really nice traditional cities, towns in Italy that you can see all those colors with bright pink buildings with, yellow or green windows and doors. And it just so it matches. So this thing spread all across the city. And finally, people and the magician were content. And this is why we need diversity in our lives.
Hello and welcome to a cornucopia of tales and tellers. This week, Simona and myself are joined with Despina from Greece. Welcome, Despina. How are you?
Hello. Very nice. Thank you. Very well.
Nice one. So we've got an North Atlantic Ocean plus Mediterranean feel to today's podcast. So Despina, could you tell us something about your story within stories and storytelling, and
absolutely
how it's important to you?
Okay, so my first interaction with storytelling came from my granny. She used to tell a story to me and my two elder sisters when we were kids. We're like the three daughters in the fairy tale. I'm the youngest one, by the way. So yeah, she gave us nice stories to keep us occupied when otherwise we would be bothering the family. So it was and still is a very nice way to occupy kids and make their brains function differently, like out of the box. Because while listening to stories, you create all those mental images. You needn't watch anything on a screen. It's just your brain doing all the work. So yeah, this was my first interaction with story tales. And then while I was teaching, when I started working as a teacher, as an English teacher, my job and storytelling were like two separate things in my mind. I had not put the pieces of the puzzle together until I came across David Heathfield. So I had already started in getting involved with stories as a hobby, and in an amateur level, of course. And while we were at the first lockdown, this was the first time I watched a webinar given by David through the British Council. This was my first encounter with him. And so I got so hooked immediately. And then I came in touch with him. I actually sent him a mail. And then he told me all these things we know about Crest. And I thought it was a great idea. So I should give it a try. And I did. And then I wanted some more. And then I wanted some more. Right? Well, I still want more, the truth is. So it was a lovely experience.
Had you... is it similar to me then, where I had storytelling was over here and teaching English was over here, but for years they just never came together, really?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was telling stories for about 5 years when I realized that I could actually incorporate it in my curriculum. So, well, the results are amazing. I mean, everybody likes it. Kids like it, teens love it, and adults ask for it. So there is no generation that excludes stories in learning. And it's a much more natural way to teach, actually, and learn. Because as we've read and heard 1,000 times, we're hardwired to storytelling. It's been done for since the beginning of time for us.
Is there an area of storytelling that you've always, is there certain topics that you've always enjoyed over others, or is there certain areas that you tend to read or listen to or tell more than others? Certainly in Greece, you guys have, world famous stories. It's almost cheating how good the stories are coming out of Greece. So for example, is mythology one that you tell, or is it quite an international mix of tales you tell?
Well, interesting question, Alan. Thank you for that. So at this point, I am torn between mythology and folklore because I love both so much and I use both. But since mythology is more or less known to my students, at least, I use it more for storytelling audiences, especially non-Greek ones, who some of them actually hear it for the first time, whereas I use more folk tales for my students and maybe even international ones, because what tales actually do is show us, prove to us how we're all connected worldwide. It's all human tales. You have the same patterns and motives going on around the globe, maybe even among civilizations who have not actually interacted. And it's the same tales. It's the same stories, because they are all human stories. And it's amazing when you actually realize that.
I like the idea of the two cultures. They've never met, but they're telling stories about each other as well. I think that's a really nice idea.
Well, they are telling the same stories, like stories within families, or the same, let's say, challenges the hero has to overcome in order to pass to another maturity level, to pass to the next level. And I guess that throughout human history, the basis of the stories is actually similar. And it's been similar since time immemorial. Mm-hmm. It doesn't change. This is the bottom line. I think this is the reason why we get so hooked by stories.
Yeah. Simona, would you jump between folklore and mythology? Or will you stick to one over the other?
If I'm teaching, this is what I do, of course. But if I'm teaching, I don't really look at what kind of story I'm choosing. But I generally choose the right story for the topic I want to focus on. Or, for example, if I'm teaching grammar or vocabulary, I need a story that has that grammar topic or the vocabulary I want to include in my lesson. So it's not, for me, when talking about English teaching, English learning, it's not really about what kind of story I'm telling, if it's a myth, a folk tale, or whatever, but more about what I want to discuss about with my students also, what kind of activity I want to do with them. But I understand what Despina is saying about the fact that she doesn't use mythology into her lessons, because of course she likes Greek mythology, I guess so. Is that right, Despina? Yes?
Yes, absolutely.
And their students are Greek, I guess, and they know those stories. So it may be that they've already listened to those stories over and over again. They may be bored. At the same time, I think I would use those stories maybe under another light, so you can modify the stories to make them more interesting. For example, with teenagers, making them modern life events, or maybe you could use them with the kids because they know the stories, so they will focus on the language more than on the story, because they already know the story, so it's easier for them to understand what you're saying, so you can focus on the language. Is that clear?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I stole the an idea from you about 2 years ago when you were talking about the comparatives and superlatives with Finn McCool. That never occurred to me before, so that was good. The Italian students loved that. But yeah, Despina, what would your favorite sort of tale to tell in the classroom be? Is there one you always fall back on and go, "This always works"?
Well, my favorite genre, the best one to my liking, and probably for that reason, the one I actually perform the best, maybe, is magic folklore. So I do not modernize it. I don't do that. I actually stick to the old folklore. Like you have the king and you have the villain and then the hero and, you know, the classical stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's very different from one tale to another, and especially if you're using international tales. I mean, the names change, even the names can make a tale more exotic. If I give them an African tale, for example, the names sound really weird. Maybe they've never heard such names before.
Well, that's an interesting idea, because could you tell, for example, to maybe a class who don't know, would you ever try tell a tale that may be familiar, like a European folk tale, but simply give it South American names or give it Asian names to sort of, you know, maybe if we don't actually know the story, but we want to change the culture, or is that cheating?
Well, I never thought of that. No, I don't consider it as cheating, because every teller has the right to intervene and you have to make the story yours somehow. Mm. So why not? But I think that if I wanted to give them some Asian folklore, I would actually use a real Asian story, maybe from Japan or something that I really liked. Because it's not just the names, of course, it's the culture as well. And you're just diving into it through stories. You're getting deep.
When for you was the crossover between, when did you match teaching to storytelling? Was there a point where they did just hit and you remember going, oh, this really works, as opposed to them being separate entities?
Yeah, well, I started experimenting after the first crest. And then I saw that it works. I wasn't very in it yet, because I needed to feel more comfortable, more at ease with it. So I went slowly, gradually. And then when I saw that there was actual interaction and that the kids did react the way I expected them, and they would use the story they had, the first most important lesson for life, this is a life skill, not just learning a language, is to learn how to listen attentively. And I mean, the results were obviously perfect. And then when they had to repeat parts of the story, the second very important skill, language skill they used, was paraphrasing. They had to use the story they remembered, but they had to use their own words, their own vocabulary. Some of them might have caught a few words and they would be able to use them. I mean, new vocabulary. That was amazing. And then there was the reaction, of course. Okay, we had fun playing roles and getting into more drama, etc. And okay, let me tell you this anecdote. So one of my students, whom I'm preparing for the Sutton Michigan exam this May, a very bright young girl of about 15. So I'm telling you this story where you have the Greek folklore, sorry, you have the two elder jealous sisters of the younger one's happiness, and they destroy it, right? They sabotage it. So when we come to the happy end and the heroine goes away with the prince to be married, etc., girl says, I wonder if she ever returned to her family or if she took them with her. And I think, well, she did not come from a royal family, so I see it a bit hard that she would leave all this splendor and riches to go back to her family. She probably took them with her. And then I have this idea, and I ask her, so what do you think about the two sisters? Would she take those ones too? And she says, oh, then, well, yeah, they would be living in the doghouse. Right?
Oh, very good, living in the doghouse.
You get excellent responses.
Yeah. I think that's worth a homework exercise of doing what's part two of the story. I've challenged students to do that before, is see if they can write a part two of, like, even a famous one that they all, like, everybody knows, like one of the Grimm's brothers or something. What's part two, and see what they can do as well. But yeah, I like sending one of,
like,
the
a sequel, right?
Yeah, I like sending one of the characters to live in the doghouse. Or Little Red Riding Hood, and the wolf is just a puppy or something. Who knows? Maybe they had an interaction beforehand. Who knows?
Yeah, so, or if there is a moral in the story, you know, something we need to learn, you can actually ask for their ideas before you hand them with the original story come out. And it's very interesting because you come across gender stereotypes, for example, or the gap between the rich and the poor and stuff like that, that you still see in society. So there are things you actually talk about, and they come from life, not just a story.
Yeah.
And this is very interesting as well.
Nice. Do you have a story for us today, since we're a storytelling podcast?
Yeah, actually I do. I have this great story which I heard from Keith. Unfortunately, I don't know his last name. He's part of the Litchfield Storytellers. And it goes like this. Once there was a rich, rich merchant. He lived in a big city. And one day he took his servants and decided to go for a walk across the central square because he had some business to attend to. Now, on that particular day, the square was crowded and there were many people gathered. There was a spectacle. There were jugglers and there were fire eaters and such. So because of the crowd gathered in the center of the square, his servants preceded him, pushing the people aside so this very rich merchant, the Lord, would pass. Not being bothered by anyone. So silk gown, fur scarf, gold medallions hanging on his neck, and a big purse hanging on his belt. He was walking the square when suddenly there was an accident. The juggler missed a ball and they flew inside the crowd and everybody stepped back in order not to step on it, etc. So there was this big push and pull and people started going backwards. And even the Lord himself was kind of pushed away until his servants managed to push back the crowd and make room for him to pass again. So he crossed the square, went away. Later on the same day, the poor guy was passing through the empty square when he stepped on something. And you know how you feel when there's something underneath your foot. He stepped on something big and he bent down and saw that it was this purse full of coins. Immediately, he took it with him and went back to his house and told his wife what he had found. Now, these people, they were poor, but they were also very honest. And they were just sitting there wondering how they could return this fortune to its rightful owner. They actually opened the purse and they found that inside there were silver coins, and they put one on top of the other, on top of the other, until they had 10 of them, and then they made another 10 and another 10, and there were 10 rows of 10 silver coins, which, okay, imagine that at that time, 3 silver coins were the money they made in a year. So we're talking about a fortune. It was a lot of money. They did not want to keep it. It did not feel right. They wanted to return the money. So let's leave them in the kitchen, wondering what they should do. Back to the merchant's house. When he realized his purse was gone, immediately he sent out the servants to the square. They carried looking for the purse everywhere, but of course it was nowhere to be found. So then he had one of them talk to the people and say, "Hear me out, my lord has lost his purse. Anyone who finds it will get 3 silver coins as a reward upon return." So when they heard this, the couple, they obviously thought that this must be the owner of the purse. So the man put all the coins back inside, took the purse, and went to the rich merchant's house. There he was received and taken to a room where the rich merchant was waiting. He said, "My lord, I found this in the market the other day, and I think it must be yours, so I'm returning it to you." The merchant took the purse, looked at that guy up and down, like measuring him. Then he emptied the purse and started counting the coins. When he was finished, he said, "There are 100 silver coins in here." "Well, yes, my lord," said the honest man. "This is what I found." "Well," said the merchant, "I had put 120 silver coins in my purse, and I can only see 100 of them here. If you want your reward, you must bring back the other 20. Now, the honest man, the poor guy. Okay, he had been mistreated several times in his life because of his economic financial situation. But at that point, he decided that he would not take it. He felt he was being mistreated, and he felt that all his honesty was blown to the wind, because obviously the merchant would not want, was trying to avoid paying the reward he had promised. Plus, he was accusing him of being a thief, so he had it. He said, "No, this is not so. I'm sorry, my lord. I found 100 silver coins. We must take the matter to the mayor." "To the mayor," said the merchant. "Okay, let's do that." Feeling so sure about himself, because, of course, he was doing business with the mayor. He was the rich merchant. They had done many businesses together in the past, so, yeah. Would the mayor want to cross him? Uh-oh. So, feeling all confident, they went to the mayor, presented the matter to him. "Oh, the mayor, okay." Of course, he did not want to cross the merchant. Indeed, they had done good business together and profitable one. But on the other hand, he was elected by the people, and if he wanted to continue being elected by the people, he could not have the simple folk think that he was being dishonest. So he said, "I'm very sorry, I cannot make a decision about this. We'd better take the matter to the judge." So as it was, the next day the judge would pass from their city, and they waited for His Highness. When the judge appeared, the two people were brought in front of him. And the poor guy, looking humbly to the floor, explained his side of the story. The rich merchant, chin up high in the sky and puffing out his chest, gave his side of the story. The judge said, he looked at the poor guy, he said, "You strike me as an honest bloke." "Thank you, my lord," said he. And then he looked at the rich merchant and he said, "You, sir, you seem to be an honest man."
"Well, I hope so, my lord," said the merchant.
"We must have a break here. I will go and have lunch, and I will tell you what I decided when I come back." So this judge, well, he was a clever man. He was the right hand of the king, and rightfully so, because he was always very just. Now, this was hot potato. very difficult to decide what to do. When I heard the story, I was trying to find the solution. It is kind of hard, but this guy, when he had his fill and returned, he called them back in. He said, "Gentlemen, you both look like very honest people." The honest person looking down, the bridge merchant puffing out. He said, "I will tell you what I decided. You, sir," he said to the poor guy, "you said that when you found the purse, there were 100 silver coins inside." "Yes, my lord," said he. "And you, sir, you said that when you lost your purse, there were 120 silver coins inside." "Of course, my lord, this is what I've said," said the merchant. "Well, clearly," he said to the rich merchant, "this is not your purse." Now the rich guy's jaw dropped open, but before he could take a breath and start complaining about it, the judge returned to the mayor and said, "You will keep this purse with 100 silver coins for 3 months. If in 3 months' time nobody comes asking for them, you will hand them over to this honest man who has brought them to us. And you, sir," he said to the merchant, "let us hope that one day another honest man, as honest as this one, comes to us and brings us your purse." And that was the end of the tale.
Brilliant. That's one of those tales where you're trying to work out what's happening right until the end. It's one of those where you're trying to think ahead, but you can't, you're not quite sure. Brilliant. Do you tell that to the students to get them to predict what's happening?
Of course
next?
I do. Yeah. Not only that. Well, okay. At first, my first pit stop is when the poor person finds the purse. So what would you do? You find a wallet in the street today, full of money, a lot of money, no idea inside. What do you do? Yeah, so this is the first interaction with them.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I do not give them the judge's decision on the plate. I have them sleep over it. And the next time we have class, they can tell me what they have come up with. And then before I do even that, one of them has to be the poor guy who has found the wallet, and I'm the judge, and they have to tell me their side of the story. And another one would be the rich merchant, and he would have to give me, or she, depends, their side of the story. And after playing the roles, then I tell them the final decision. Yeah.
Can I steal the idea?
Absolutely, yeah. This is the point. That was the point exactly for us to share.
That's beautiful. And it's a little bit cruel that you don't give them the answer until next time.
Well, they have to use their brains, right? That's part of our job.
Yeah, that's nice.
I like the idea of asking students for multiple possibilities. And then instead of saying, "Here's a right or wrong answer, here is the answer that I have." So everybody's allowed to be right.
Exactly.
Does that make sense? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Brilliant. I love that.
That's brilliant.
So do I. I mean, it's very useful for us in the classroom. Yeah.
And you can also turn it into the morality debate as well, with what do you do if you find money on the street? As simple as that. Because then you have them discussing it in English in class as well. So it's open to so many possibilities too. It's one of those stories that there's so many possible activities can be taken from it.
Exactly. And they can take either one of the three roles, right? Mm. Okay, and the mayor is a politician. We don't care about that role, but the other people. I mean, they have to be able to think critically, even if they were the judges and you have one person who seems to be honest. They have brought money back. They could have kept it, of course, in the first place. And then you have the other person who's obviously lying, but you cannot tell them to their face because you need to be diplomatic, let's say, right? So you have to keep the balance. You cannot misjudge anyone, and you cannot cross anyone directly. So it's like magical.
What's been the most memorable idea put forward by one of your students in the past for how the story concludes, or one of the answers you've got out of it?
Okay, I have to tell you that several would just keep the money.
Let's start with that.
I mean, I'm sure there's other teachers listening to this going, yeah, if that was 100 times a teacher's wage, I'd take the money.
And some of them tried to implicate the servants, like have one of the servants make a side deal and have one of the servants tell the truth that their master is lying, actually.
Someone touts on them then.
Yeah.
Oh, there's plenty.
And they're all surprised in the end. Nobody comes to the, This is a very wise decision. I don't think that judge took it over lunch, actually. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, Lisbeth, thank you very much for telling us your tale. And
you're very welcome.
With a multitude of activities that can be taken into the classroom as well. Thank you very much. That's greatly appreciated. Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Despina, for joining us on today's cornucopia of Tales and Tellers.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you very much, everybody, for listening. I've been Alan, and Simona's been Simona, hopefully. And we'll see you again on the next episode of a cornucopia of Tales and Tellers. Thank you very much, guys.
Bye.
Great.